Ramesh Thakur sums up how we see our relations with the Asian region like this. Do we want to defend ourselves from Asia-sourced threats, be smarter in doing business with Asia, or be part of Asia? The coalition seems to be pursuing the first, Labor's promising the second, but neither seems interested in the third. Professor Ramesh questions, for instance, why so few Asian Australians hold positions of power within our major institutions at a range of levels, and as we've heard, Melbourne and Sydney are becoming Eurasian cities. Why aren't we seeing this represented in our parliament, our government, or other positions of power? And he even offers some very good competitive imagery from Canada that he thinks may claim the crown as the best migrant country in the world. Ramesh is co-convener of the Asia Pacific Leadership Network for Nuclear Non-Proliferation and Disarmament at the Crawford School at the ANU now. And welcome to the program.
Thank you, Geraldine.
I do wonder what your response to George Megalogenis was, first up.
Well, that was very interesting. It was fascinating listening into that conversation. Effectively, what he seems to be arguing is history is legacy for us. John Howard and company rejected the notion that geography should be destiny. And George is now arguing that really, demography is destiny. And many of the themes he picked up, I think, illustrate my argument. But also, just as a quick question, the inaugural issue of this journal, how many Asian Australians are represented in the authorship?
Yes, look, I had it beside me a moment ago. That's a very good question. Okay.
And this, you can extend that to the media presence in general.
It's sort of slowly changing, don't you think, or not?
It is. It is. But look,
I mean, Michelle Guthrie, our own MD, is part Chinese.
It is. But let me start with the fact that I have triple citizenship. One of the advantages being that I can never even dream of getting into parliament. Canadian, New Zealand, and Australian. And I've lived, obviously, in these countries for long periods of time, 11 years in Canada. And most recently, I came back to Australia from Canada in 2011. So the images of Canada were fresh in my mind. And you go to the streets of Toronto or Vancouver, and they're very similar to Melbourne and Sydney and Brisbane in terms of on the streets, you see people, Asian, mixed race. It's part of the normal cityscape and landscape. You don't bat an eyelid. But you don't see the same representation in public offices in Australia. And that's such a striking feature. As I said in that essay, 17 Sikh MPs in the federal parliament in Canada, plus some more Indo-Canadians. Then you get to the Chinese. Where are they in Australia? They seem to be absent. And the point that George was making, politics has not engaged with them. And if it is the case that they fit in and they're no trouble and therefore we ignore them, that's just creating a long-term problem. So I think the point that George was making does gel very nicely with my arguments that we need to engage in a bit of introspection as to where we are. And because I knew I was coming in here, I was just thinking, you know, look, I've worked a lot, let me put it this way, I've worked a lot over the past 20, 25 years with Gareth Evans, including traveling extensively both around the region and around the world. And Gareth has some interesting stories and a background. He says, and he's now confirmed that in his new political memoir, the book Incorrigible Optimist, he said to me often that the cohort of foreign ministers he felt most comfortable engaging with at a personal level were the ASEAN foreign ministers.
Yeah, he said that.
And he recalled the story during the various discussions moving to the Cambodian peace settlement. One of those was the Jakarta informal meeting process, I think. Around one of those meetings, during a break, he accidentally opened the door and walked into a caucus of the ASEAN foreign ministers, apologized, was closing the door as he left, and the Indonesian foreign minister, with whom he had a good personal relationship, Ali Alatas, said, "It's all right, Gareth, you might as well come in, you're one of us anyway." That is something difficult to visualize for me with Julie Bishop.
Really?
Penny Wong, maybe. Bob Carr, certainly. And that's something that I think we need to think through as well. How many of our leaders have that degree of familiarity and ease in dealing with Asian colleagues compared to Western colleagues? and what is our public face in the region. So yes, I think the points that George were making were absolutely consistent with what I was saying in my essay.
And this dichotomy that you highlight, Labor's emphasis on business possibilities and the coalition on security issues in mm-hmm. terms of the region, didn't the Australia in the Asian Century, the Julia Gillard paper, didn't that attempt to despite what you're saying, didn't attempt to go further than that?
Well, I went through that paper very carefully. I don't think so, no. And as I said in the essay, look at the composition of the task force. You begin with that. And in a sense, you lose your Asian audience starting from that. Just as you'd lose if you had a major government policy paper dealing with women's issues, for example, and you didn't have any women on the task force, it would not have any credibility. So there are those issues. But maybe, you know, Julie Bishop in her address to the Australian Institute of International Affairs National Conference and Penny Wong, they made one point which I think is relevant, and I agree entirely with that, and that is it's wrong to always emphasize the dichotomy. Our relationship with the United States in net terms is a positive asset in our dealings with Asia also. So I don't think we have to choose between them. The question is getting the balance and emphasis and nuance right. And again, the George point about demographics will determine how we approach foreign policy in due course, I think is correct in that sense.
So what do you think, having, because you were born in India, weren't you?
I was.
Yes, and then you went you were educated in Canada, did you?
I was educated in Canada and I've lived and taught in Fiji and New Zealand and Japan and various things.
Yeah. Okay, so what I'm really heading at is this change in Canada that you're describing. So we've mm-hmm. now got a Sikh, you know, a turbaned man who's set up his own party, and as you say, all of these sort of visibly Sikh people occupying positions.
They are visible minorities, yes.
Visible minorities, yes. So what's if you really reflect on it, when did this start to occur and what else was happening at the same time by way of comparison with Australia in your view?
Well, Canada's advantage, I suppose, is that it never had a white Australia equivalent policy. It never had a white Canada policy. I moved to Canada in 1971. Asians were just starting to come in, so I was ahead of the curve in that sense. But we've tracked each other, and now, as George pointed out, we actually have the, I think in net terms per capita, the highest migration rate in the world, and most of them are coming from the region. In fact, I think the biggest cohort now is India rather than China even. But we haven't caught up in numbers, I suppose, even proportionately. The point about it's the wealthy and powerful who are coming from China, that doesn't apply necessarily to other parts of Asia even now. So it will come.
But I'm saying, but if you think about Canada, mm-hmm. was there somebody championing this? Was there a particularly talented group who started to win prizes for this, that and the other? Were there particularly good NGOs? I'm just intrigued by why both you and George seem to believe that Canada and New Zealand are going past us in terms of a self-described belief that they're the best welcoming countries, migration countries. And so this self-description matters in a way.
It does. And I think the answer to that is exactly the point George was making, that consciously, to begin with one political party and then all the major parties, began politically to engage with the migrant community. And then there comes a point that the vote actually becomes important. You need, for example, the Tamil vote in Toronto in some particular seats. You need the Sikh votes in British Columbia as a province, as well as Vancouver as a city. Mm. The premier in British Columbia has been a Sikh. So that at one stage, it then becomes self-perpetuating. I think there is political mileage to be made in Australia if either of the two major parties recognizes the politics and the importance of the politics.
Well, certainly Labor's, you know, in the great sort of sometimes complaint is made is that they had focused on the Chinese very definitely over many years in order to draw them in. And then, of course, some of the later Chinese actually were far more liberally inclined. So I think there has been a tussle over the Chinese. Mm-hmm. But if I hear you correctly, you're saying this is really not the answer. The answer is a much more of a sense of overtly seeking to enjoy the cultures or the culture and the different cultural repertoire, stories, mores. I wonder if that's easily doable.
Well, part of the problem, I think, is the difference in the way we pre-select in Australia compared to Canada. It's far more democratic in terms of party membership deciding on various things, including the leadership in Canada, whereas here it's the factions and the unions and various things like that, and relatively less freedom for ordinary members of political parties to choose either candidates for seats, let alone leaders.
I notice I've just got in front of me, I've got a press release from the Australian Academy of Cinema and Television Arts, which this week announced 9 Asian films nominated for the inaugural Actor Award for Best Asian Film. So that's a start, isn't it?
It is indeed. And of course, again, there is money to be made in promoting Australia as a site for making films. Bollywood, after all, is the biggest film industry in the world now.
So what would you like to see, realistically, in the next 5 years, if we are undergoing this dramatic change that George sketches, where would you like to see the energy put?
Well, look at something else. Intuitively, I think most Australians would agree that as a generalization, which of course doesn't mean that it applies to individuals, but as generalizations, Asians tend to be over rather than underachievers. If that is true, then why is that not reflected at the elite level in the media, in the politics and various things? And again, are there structural obstacles? Are there still institutional points of resistance? Or do we just not think about it? I don't want to give the wrong impression. My wife is, 6th, 7th generation Irish Australian. And a year ago, we went through South Australian outback, where she's from South Australia, and spent 2 or 3 weeks driving through the mid-north, through the Flinders Ranges and stuff like that. And I must say, at no point did I feel a lack of welcome in the local communities or feel there was any tension as a visible Indo-Australian. So I don't think there is any of that. And it's a very open, hospitable, welcoming country. But it's in the public offices that I feel that it is significantly and to me very strikingly different from Canada and even from New Zealand. I mean, New Zealand's had Asian governors general, for example. We haven't even had that.
Ramesh, thank you very much indeed for prompting us to think further.
Thank you.
Ramesh Thakur from the Crawford School at the ANU. We'll put a link on our website. I'm Geraldine Doogue. I do hope you can join me at the same time next week or online via the RN website.